But going on to vouchers, so I was in this school that was a mixed income school with about half kids from the housing projects and half people who were, they were not rich. My dad worked for the city. He was the EPA commissioner at this point, I think, and it was all people like that. Their parents were professors, or they had small businesses, or something. They were not hedge fund managers. No hedge fund manager would have been caught dead on the Upper West Side at this
point. Nobody lived on the Upper West Side.
And it was a great school for the first 4 years I was there, and then the principal left, and it collapsed. And this is actually a really common thing to happen. Principals, it turns out, make a huge difference in schools.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that I've been going through with voucher opponents is people who live in districts like that are now like the one that I lived in when I was growing up, which are they're places that are gentrifying. And the gentrifying parents are basically the customers of the school. And they're incredibly focused. First of all, their kids tend to be higher performing, which helps. It may or may not help some of the other kids. But the parents themselves are incredibly focused on the school. And a lot of them are connected. They're lawyers or whatever. They know how to work the system. And they get resources. And the dirty secret of the New York City public school system is that it does work better than most other school systems. But it works better only for schools that have a lot of middle-class, well-connected parents who suck all of the resources out of the system that are always politically sold as being for poor kids. And so, in fact, the poor kids get crap. You go out to a school in, like, East New York, and it's horrifying. The place is falling apart, et cetera, et cetera. You go to a school, but these parents, because there's poor kids in their school, they think, oh, well, it's the same thing. You know, this can work. And they don't realize that what they're having is just this – they're in what's essentially a separate school system run in parallel to the school system that serves the actual poor neighborhoods in New York that looks nothing like that school system other than some superficial things about – bureaucratic procedures that has all the best teachers in the system straight on down the line, and that they also do what happens, you know, what my parents did, right? The school fell apart and my parents pulled me out of it. And that the poor parents, the kids of the housing project, didn't have another school to go to, and their parents, my mom basically like was a homemaker, and she decided, well, I better start selling real estate, and started selling real estate and sent me to private school. So my mom went back to work basically just to pay my school fees and then the school fees for my sister. And they don't sort of experience the middle class parents persistently who say that they support public schooling don't grasp how different what public school looks like when there really is no exit and what it feels like to be a person. And it's not like I grasp it either in some sense, right? I'm not in that situation. I will never be in that situation. But I think that they dramatically oversell their commitment to public schools. I'm really offended in some way by calling that thing of being in a great public school, the same thing in any meaningful sense as the experience that kids are having in East New York or Watts or, you know, almost anywhere in Philadelphia, anywhere in DC, in Anacostia or whatever. Those aren't the same thing. They're completely different things. And what those parents have is way closer to what I got going to a private school than to what the people who are stuck in failing public schools in the United States get. And yet they treat it as if they're really similar and that their success in the system means that the system works on some fundamental level.
Okay. All right. Now, I think there's something to that. And, you know, I was prepared. I've read a lot of what you've written about vouchers and I sort of felt like I was, particularly obligated to comment on it because you'd sort of denounced a lot of people as hypocrites because they were private school parents who supported vouchers. And my view is, you know, I'm a public school parent. I'm a product of, you know, the kind of public schools that I think you said are no better than Chuck E. Cheese, grew up in New Haven and went to a high school where, you know, teacher was shot in the hall and so forth. So I think schools aren't public. I mean, my commitment to public school is never is deeper than that. Although you're right. I mean, the school that my daughter attends in Northwest is an extraordinary school. And it's partly because there's a great principal and it's partly, and it's partly because there are a lot of parents who put a lot of their own time and their own money into the school, although it's still operating within the same system. But there's a direct, you know, there's a chart in the Washington Post a few months ago where with school performance and socioeconomic background of the kids measured by probably school lunch eligibility and so forth. And, you know, it is a virtually direct correlation. It's such a direct correlation that you really want to know about the two or three schools that jump out, you know, that are the high performing schools with low income students, or you know, conversely, the lower performing schools with the high income students. I think but one reason I've always thought in my own experience, I think there's a set, and one reason I've been in the past inclined to be a voucher supporter, and I have been a voucher supporter, is that what I've seen, you know, in New Haven, not in my high school, but like in my junior high school, in New York, in Washington, is that where schools have one thing that I think makes those schools better is that they know they are in a sense competing for students.
Yeah.
So that the fact that some students, and it can be 10% of students, the fact that some students have exit strengthens voice, right? You know, if you know that
Usually.
Essay by Albert Hirschman, you know, so that strengthens the leverage, the principal, and the principal has a little leverage to say, you know, I need to keep these kids, I need this, I need that, and then the principal's kind of responsive to those families. I mean, there was an article in the Washington Post 2 weeks ago by David Nicholson, who's an editor at the Book World section of the Post, about why
which is what started this all off.
Which is what started all this off. The extraordinary thing was that it wasn't so much the actual badness of the public school that his son would have gone to, but the fact that he could not get any kind of access to that school. He couldn't get a meeting with the principal. After, you know, endless work, he and some other parents got a meeting with the principal, and after 5 minutes, the principal said, oh, I have to go take a call, and disappeared. They couldn't get a tour. They couldn't get anything. Now, it's hilarious how unlike that Lafayette School in D.C. is. It's hilarious. I mean, the principal's everywhere. She's all around. You can get her day or night. You see her, you know, working in the garden on Saturdays. It's really quite amazing. That's a huge difference right there, and that's probably related to a sense that, you know, you got to create the kind of school that these parents want to continue to use. Now, where I think I differ from you is I felt like you were relying on exit entirely. So that when people pointed out that there isn't close to the private school capacity, and certainly not the high quality private school capacity, to actually serve folks kids who are in schools that aren't performing for them, your response was, well, hey, 10 years ago there were no iPods, that, you know, those schools will emerge, which seems to me to miss the point that if you are for vouchers, it's got to be in the context of it could be a tool that would in fact improve the public schools, because 90% of kids are gonna be in public schools. You lived in a world where that's not always true, but the reality of America is that's life, and that's good.
Well, I don't know. It's the reality now, right? I mean, the reality could change. My thing is, like, first of all, I mean, my main concern about vouchers is kids either in failing rural systems or in failing urban systems. I really, you know, the plight of it, like the one of the libertarian arguments for vouchers is like, I have to pay tax dollars, I should be able to use them any way I want, and like that just leaves me unmoved. I'm not that interested in the suburban school system in sort of any capacity. It seems to work okay, and mostly because people have exit, they move around. If your school system doesn't work, then parents will sell out and they will move. And then
well,
the school system
tax base.
Right, and then the tax base will go down for the schools, and then the school system. I mean, like, you talk to any even in like the rural district that my mother comes from, where there's essentially no exit just because it's dispersed and so forth. Like, they're keenly alive to the issue of the tax base and how do they keep their constituents happy, mm-hmm. And that's not true in D.C. First of all, because the people who pay taxes are not the people who use the schools at all, right? Like, someone in Anacostia pays almost no city income tax. The funding stream is not in any way sort of sensitively connected to, but also because these people don't have any voice. I mean, like, I'm a good example. If the daughter of the city EPA commissioner is in your school, you know that if you do something wrong, the mayor is going to hear about it, and the school chancellor is going to hear about it. And that's just not true of poor parents. And it, like, so I think it's almost a chicken and egg thing that the school quality declines as the number of subsidized lunches goes up for a number of reasons, right? And like, I don't think that vouchers are going to make poor kids suddenly behave like rich kids. They have huge numbers of problems in their life. That just having a voucher isn't going to overcome, and you still have the problem of parents who aren't interested in education or who may be addicted to drugs or have, you know, working 80
jobs
or,
have 2-hour commutes.
Any number, and it's just too tired to deal with all of it, or don't speak English, don't really understand the system because they just you're still going to have huge problems. Mm-hmm. For me, the exit is powerful in two ways. Number one, it saves some kids, and like that. For me, because I don't really buy the cherry picking argument, mm-hmm. And I don't think I think people make.
And why is there some? Can you cite something that leads you to not? I mean, the cherry picking argument being that just to spell it out, being that the private schools that kids with vouchers would go to, that the kids who would go to the private schools would tend to be, you know, better off kids anyway,
right?
So that those schools would look better, and they would also leave behind a worse school.
Right. Well, we actually,
that to me is the key variable. If that's true, that's a big problem for vouchers. You don't buy it. Why?
Well, we have good data, right? We just got this study that it's still in progress, but starting to come out. They just picked poor families up and moved them to the suburbs. They didn't quibble about whether it was a school or whatever. They just picked them up and moved them to the suburbs. And there's no difference. There's randomized control study, no difference. We don't know. Like,
wait,
the parents who didn't go to the suburbs.
You said four families?
No, more than four families. I'll dig the study.
Oh, you said poor families.
Poor families.
No, I know the studies you're talking about. There's differences in some dimensions and not differences, in others. And you've got a whole set of issues there, which is a disruption. I mean, that's not comparable to simply switching schools.
But given yes and no, the kids should be doing better in school.
Well, their behavior improved and the academic performance didn't improve.
Right.
And I think there's reason to think that that the academic performance might lag behind the behavior improvement.
But I mean, we're now in year six. Mm-hmm. The cherry picking argument, we were just talking about academic performance now. If the cherry picking argument held, something should have happened by now. Those kids should be doing a little better. They're not. There's no statistical
significance. Well, how does that relate to the cherry-picking argument?
Well, but this is the thing, right? If being around other kids, if being around a small number of kids who behave well is so great, being around a huge number of kids who behave well should be amazing, and it doesn't appear to have any difference on educational outcomes. So all of the evidence, right? So you've got two separate arguments, neither of which that are made at the same time that can contradict each other.
Mm-hmm.
One of which is the argument that the kids are so bad that moving them doesn't matter, right? And if that's true, why are you moving your own kids, right? Like, okay, if the school doesn't make a difference, these kids are just so hopeless. Why are you moving your kids? If the school doesn't make any difference in educational outcomes, why are you picking your ass up and moving to the suburbs? You know, you obviously think the school matters. Otherwise, you wouldn't be trying to pick a different school for your own child.
I'm not arguing that. So
that's one argument.
That some
if the school
people
does matter,
not here might make.
Right. Right. Yeah. But I'm getting this argument made. If the school does matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the top kids left in the public school system shouldn't be allowed to exit in order to save the kids below them, right? Then morally, how did you just pick up your kid and move him to another school? Because your kid's way better than those kids. Your kid has more opportunities.
Who are you talking to here? Not you personally. Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
Just like, if you're saying to me, like, well, we can't destroy the system. We have to leave those top kids there because if we allow them to exit, that will destroy the system. Your kids shouldn't have exited. You shouldn't. Like, and there are a lot of people who do this, right? David Nicholson is one of them. Like, you should not have taken your kid out of that school. You have every bit as you have more moral responsibility than the parents of those kids, because
you have
opportunity.
Right. Nobody has a.
And so, neither of the arguments that are made work for me. Either you, if those people, we have a moral obligation to leave them in school, you have a moral obligation to stay. I don't think there are systemic obligations that differ substantially from personal obligations. And I think this is true about, you know, and the other thing about collective action problems is, and so what they're positing basically is this thing that economists call a collective action problem, which is, like, we're all better off if we do something, like stay, because then the school system will be better and so forth. But if people start exiting, then everyone has to exit, because then they become individually each made better off. And so how you coordinate the collective action that will improve everyone's life is difficult. The thing about collective action problems is there aren't partial solutions to them. If you allow some exit, which we have, and I don't know how you can stop that exit, you can't keep people from moving. Economic segregation is real, particularly in a world of zoning. But once any exit has happened, the best solution for everyone left in the system is exit. And so you can't have a partial equilibrium, which is what they're trying to basically build out of this.
But that's ridiculous, because you do have a partial equilibrium in schools where a combination of, you know, the possibility of exit, which enhances voice, and parents with time and energy and so forth and commitment to the school, you know, changes that school.
Right. But and I agree. I think exit, this is the thing, is that I think exit works in a number of ways. I don't think that there's one way in which exit is good and others in which it is bad. Like, exit, in fact, doesn't just destroy the system, which is what people think. Exit can improve the system. I completely agree with you on that. Is that
right.
the possibility of exit with vouchers, and I think demonstrably does. There's evidence that, like, charter school, when you have charter schools or vouchers, things in the surrounding area actually get better because principals and teachers and so forth start getting afraid. What it does do, though, right? What does exit do? It diminishes the power of the groups that now do better in the system. So it diminishes, for example, exit diminishes the power of the teachers' union. Absolutely. If teachers are afraid for their jobs, if they're afraid their school will get closed, they have suddenly less power. And that is at least I think, a powerful part of the visceral reaction that I'm getting from a lot of Democratic wonks, is that they have a reflex to protect the teachers' union. And I also get a lot of arguments.
Do you think that's true? Do you think that any of the people who've criticized you have some tie? So if, you know, I mean, I think the hostility among, you know, I think the general sense that teachers' unions are not necessarily a big positive part of the change, which actually I think is exaggerated, yes, Democratic operatives think of the teachers' union as important because they're important, you know, whatever, one-third of the Democratic convention delegates or whatever, but not from Ezra Klein.
There is a perception among I do. I think that progressives perceive this to be, and possibly validly, because I think that a lot of conservatives do attack the teachers' union in a really excessive way. I mean, I think the teachers' union create problems, but the system is what creates problems. Like, the teachers' unions are part of this poisonous interaction in urban and some rural school districts where there are a huge number of parts of the system that don't work that well and have too much power, and then they interact in ways that are extremely bad. If you blew away the teachers' union, like, New York City schools wouldn't just suddenly get better. But I think that the teachers'
That's
union
a good
blocks
concession.
A lot of the things that could make New York City schools better. Does that make any sense? Like,
oh,
it's
yeah,
not
I mean,
like
No question. And if, like, you know, teachers' unions should have embraced charter schools. You know, they should have been part of the school reform movement at times when they were held back.
But I think that they consistently are. They fight anything that would let you know how the schools are doing. And I understand teaching is hard to measure. Like, I do understand their arguments. But the fact is, like, it's all we've got. Okay? We don't test them. How do we measure how they're doing? You know,
right.
Yes,
but that fight is over. That fight's done.
But it's,
that fight's done. And Richard Kallenberg's book about Al Shanker, which is a great book, talks a lot about how he kind of led the sort of second teachers' union into the
right.
school reform movement.
So I think that this often gets perceived. Like, people consistently attack me for wanting to attack the teachers' union. I don't care about the teachers' union.
Okay. Well,
like,
either way,
they're fine. Whatever.
Okay,
they're
great.
Nice people, but I just don't care.
Okay. Let's confine this to a small issue, which is not. You know, it's like if there were five people here, you might have arguments with them. But
no. Right.
I don't have an argument on the teachers' union, and I don't have an argument. I mean, I think that the I'm not a hypocrite. So you don't sort of have that argument with me. The issue I have is that I think if one's approach to vouchers is it's all exit, we're going to get all these kids have the right to exit. And first of all, I don't really understand how as a libertarian you would attribute this. You know, it's about the allocation of public funds. It's not that you have a right to go to – everybody has a right to go to a different school as long as it's a qualified school. We're talking about the allocation of funds. So to me, the question is when you're allocating this block of public funds for this thing that we've declared a public good or a merit good or whatever, when you're allocating these public funds, is the best way to do it through a voucher system that assumes that schools will emerge from it, or is it through, you know, a core public school system? And I think if you have a voucher, I think you have to have a core public school system. 90% of kids are going to go to that public school system. Maybe in some theoretical mind, you know, thought experiment, you could imagine a completely voucherized system from the start. But we're going to start with this base of the public school system. So the question is, does this power of exit help reinforce the voice and the other things that would actually improve those schools? And what upsets me about voucher supporters is that there seems to be no interest in that question. It doesn't, you know, you've asserted that there are some studies that show it. I don't think so. I think that question actually gets hard to answer. It gets wiped out of the studies in Milwaukee and so forth, which only look at do kids who actually exercise exit do better or not. And I feel like I have nothing in common with a voucher supporter whose approach is, you know, it's like iPods. There'll be millions of private schools.
No, that's not exactly what I said.
That's not
like,
true.
I was responding to people who were like, there won't be any more private schools. Like, There aren't private schools, and therefore, like, we shouldn't have vouchers because there's no private schools to set. And it's, first of all, not true. Every urban area in America has Catholic schools with huge amounts of overcapacity right now. But second of all, the Catholic Church built this huge infrastructure that now it doesn't have parishioners to fill. And not every
which
urban
creates
area,
actually this
most
is
urban
this
areas,
is
especially just, in the most failing places that we're looking at, like New York and Chicago and so forth. But second of all, you know, the assumption that there will just be no more schools, that no one is going to build a school, is retarded. You know, like, someone will build a school. People want to educate poor kids. They can't do it, right? If they don't want to work within the public school system, which is Byzantine enough to kill the spirit of many people who would like to help, then they have no way to do it, because getting donors to fund public – some people do, but it's really, really tough.
Right.
And, you know, so this is a way to give people who really want to do this an opening to build more schools. I think there will be more schools. I don't know that there will be 100%.
Charter schools does a lot of that. And the fact is that's building a school is not an easy thing to do. It's a very, very difficult thing.
It is not an easy thing to do, but it is a 90 times harder thing to do within the public school system. The system is it's ossified. And it is set up in so many ways to restrain people from exercising initiative. And I think this is the legacy of first the progressive reform movement, which was reacting to real abuses and so forth, but second of all, the legal movement of the 60s and 70s to sue for all of these rights. What it's created is, and also the unionization of teachers and principals, and the proliferation of community action and so forth. What this has left us with is a system in which almost no one can move, and all of the energy of school reform gets consumed in these just incredibly tedious battles in which people try to sort of marginally increase very small amounts of territory, just because the system is done. It without bulldozing huge portions of it, it's simply unable to change itself. Is what I honestly feel about these urban school systems. The government has become unable, so exit for some kids, but also that I think exit may change that dynamic.
But this is two different things. This is two different. See,
yes,
when you say the first thing,
the market's working more than one way.
When you say bulldoze the whole thing, This is when I feel like, you know, for me to support vouchers is like liberal supporters of the Iraq war on you know, grounds of human rights or democracy. It's like, I can't support vouchers if I'm getting into a movement that's actually about bulldoze this whole system because it's all about the lefties of the 60s and, some screw-ups. If you tell me it's about a way of, you know, using exit to improve, to change the motives and improve the public school system, which you respect and think we should have one of, great. But if you tell me it's about bulldozing this system because it all sucks, I can't be part of that movement.
I don't care if we have a public school system or not. I'm pretty much indifferent to what I'm interested in is educating kids. And if the public school system does a good job at educating the kids it's supposed to educate, you know, like in some theoretical libertarian la la land, there would be no public post office and there would be no public school system.
Right.
But it just doesn't interest me as a political question. What I care about now is that there's a huge number of kids, the hardest to serve kids. It does the worst job at the thing that's hardest. And it has, for 50 years, completely failed to improve at doing that job, and it's getting worse all the time. So if it is a choice between the lives of those kids and the public school system, for me, it's the lives of those kids. The public school system, if what it took to educate them was shutting down the public school system tomorrow, I would do it. And if it, what it took to educate them was keeping the public school system in place, I would do that. I come neither to create, you know, to praise the public school system nor to bury it. What I'm talking about, and I also think that what you're talking about is like the existence of a public school system in some theoretical, beautiful sense that there is this thing that we all do together, which I don't personally doesn't sort of inspire me.
Well, I think,
but
you make
I also
a very
don't
good
want to
point.
Destroy. What I'm talking
about
is
the actual
system.
I think you make a good
point,
which is we don't all actually do it together. And that's, I think
right.
that's actually a good point.
But what I'm talking about is the actual system. I mean, the actual, like, all of the bureaucratic rules and all of the just accumulated dross of 100 years of partial political reform that I think has made it impossible to educate poor kids. Really poor kids in neighborhoods that are full of other poor kids and no middle class parents. We used to be able to educate those kids. I mean, America used to educate the kids from the ghettos in 1900 came out of public school systems able to read and write. And at eighth grade went into jobs able to read and write. And that's not happening now. You get people graduating from high school or dropping out who can't read and write, who can't do basic math.
Every measure suggests that kids now are performing at a level, you know, that there's a steady increase.
The mean,
and we have
the mean has gone up.
Well, yeah.
The tails are not getting better.
Some of the tails are not getting better.
Yeah. But I'm interested in the tails. The mean is doing fine.
Yeah.
Again, like suburban schools, I don't care. Fine, great. They can exist. They can not exist. If suburbs want to have public schools, I don't live in one. And I'm happy for D.C. to have public schools, provided, again, that the tails are getting better. And they're not. They're getting worse. And so, you know, part of this argument, right, about the cherry picking is it's already happened. We picked all the cherries. There are no cherries left in these schools to pick. These are the hardest to educate kids. They're the desperate kids. There are some kids at the top who could get out. And I think it would be worthwhile to save them, because I think that my feeling about that, right, is that, like, as a society, they don't owe us anything. They don't owe the other kids in that class anything. We owe them an education.
No, I think that's fine. I think that's fine, and I think you're right. And that's in the same way that many that parents who have an option, you know, very few parents would never take that option,
right,
under any circumstances.
So I don't want to argue about the public schools. I mean, I think we can improve the system with exit, and I think that a lot of the way to bulldoze all of this stuff that I'm talking about, all of this ossified systematic procedural, just the way in which all of these interest groups in the system are locked into this battle, in which the kids are, like, in schools where there's no exit, the kids are irrelevant. You know, like, people there would like to teach kids, but it's not their first priority for most of them. Right, like, they have other things that they need to do. They have to have salaries. They have to. There aren't that many people, because the people who want to teach kids, right, they have to transfer out. They can't handle being in these schools. It's too difficult. There's no bonus pay for it. There's no hazard pay. You have to be like one scary, super committed ideologue to stay in a, to be a good teacher who stays in a failing public school. at the point at which you have enough sonority to transfer. And there's some people who do it, and God bless them, but there are very few. There's some principals who do it, and God bless them, mm-hmm. but there are very mm-hmm. few. Mm-hmm. Most of the people in the schools are there, including the teachers, because they can't go anywhere else. And so I think, you know, creating exit for those people will change the system for those remaining behind, and maybe it'll change it enough that, like, 5% of the students take vouchers and no one else even wants them because they like their school and it's great.
But it sounds
and
like
that would
the
be a fine outcome for me. I don't want to destroy the public school system per se.
Okay.
But
well,
what I'm interested in is how do we change all of the stuff that's in the system right now that is just – and so what I had, like, Ezra Klein responding to me and saying, look, there are a lot of really serious academics and they really think – and libertarians are just wing nuts. It's like you go talk to those really serious academics, and they have to start. There's a famous joke that they tell about economists is that there's an economist, a chemist, and an engineer stranded on a desert island, and they have all these cans from the shipwreck, but no can opener. And they all get to work on the problem, and the chemist is trying to build something that will, like, explode the cans, and the engineer is trying to build a catapult that will launch them into the air and break them on a rock, and the economist says, come on, this is ridiculous. Just assume a can opener.
Right.
And that's what all of these very serious educational reformers do, really. They have to first assume a system that's in some way functional. And for the poor schools are not in any way functional.
But why? I mean, that's a statement. What's an example of somebody assuming that? I mean, everything I've read, you know, you understand what there's no assumption that the Milwaukee school system or the Newark school system is other than what it is.
What I mean
is
someone who says, like, I've got a new way to educate poor kids. Well, that assumes that, like, the teachers union isn't going to torpedo your new or change your new plan in such a way as to remove the elements that work. Or that it isn't going to go through a political battle in which some crazy person is going to come along and cut out half of what you do and substitute something. Like, it assumes that you can actually implement the plan as written.
As opposed to vouchers, which are actually, you guarantee, are going to be implemented as written.
Well, no, but I mean, vouchers, like, I'm not saying that any voucher program will work. If we give everyone $1.50, that's not going to work, right? There's not going to be a school that will satisfy.
Right.
Yes, I have to say there's a minimum price level. Okay. You have to price for kids who have disabilities. They have to be priced differently. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that if you provide a voucher of, say, $5,000, $5,000 to $7,000, depending on the cost of living in the area, the cost of business in the area, and so forth, to every kid in the school. Not all the kids will be able to leave because there won't be enough schools to serve it. Schools will spring up to serve some of them. In the process, the market can do things that a government centrally planned system is just not able to do. It's not able to innovate as quickly because it does one thing. You know, you have a centrally planned system, by definition, is set up to have a bunch of rules that tells everyone how to do the one thing. And it measures inputs rather than outputs.
How is it that in the good old days, before the awful liberals of the 60s came in, we were able to educate kids in a public system?
Well, and partly because we didn't have all the rules. This is the bureaucratic culture of America since 1900 is completely different from what it used to be. It's 100, I mean, completely different. It's not just the 60s lawsuits was a big thing. The revolution in the legal culture of the 60s and 70s, I don't think anyone would argue, it's revolutionized the way that anything happens. Everything now takes 8 times as long as it used to.
But schools were, I mean, there was no, you know, the Deweyan revolution didn't take place when Dewey was alive. It took place in the 60s. Before that, schools were very rigid, rule-based systems.
No.
You did what
by
you did,
themselves, and, right? But there weren't the kinds of constraints on things like firing teachers, changing curriculum, trying new things. There's no way to experiment in the New York City school system. You are given a curriculum, and that is the curriculum you will use. These are the textbooks you will use. This is the, you know, if a teacher does this, there are 17 rules dictating how it must be done, when they take their lunch breaks. A principal can't ask anything of the teachers other than what's specified in their contract. The school system can't ask anything from a principal other than what's specified in its contract. There's no flexibility. People are like little cogs in this machine, and the machine we know is broken, right? The machine doesn't work.
Right.
But you can't. You also can't change it, because every time you try to change it, all of the cogs activate and say, "Well, but you know, I don't want to. I don't want anything different." So it's just, it's a poisonous thing. There's no way to change it. All of the interest groups of the system, in all of the interest groups dedicated to changing the system, the only people whose voices are absent are the customers. You know, the only people who have no power or at all in this system are the people who were supposed to educate, the parents and children who are supposed to be the constituents of it.
Right. And I think your point is to the, particularly the parents who have no mobility.
Right.
Either the economic mobility to use private schools or the geographic mobility to move.
And I think that encourages the ossification.
Okay.
That we you know, that what I'm hoping is that you get a combination of private schools as a place where there is experimentation, where we learn, we don't know how to educate poor kids very well. And I think that that's mm-hmm. something that the voucher opponents are saying, and they're right, but they don't know either.
Right.
I'm hoping is that we could find out by having a bunch of little places, each of which try, and when someone finds something good, other people have to copy it because they're afraid of losing their students if they don't.
Right.
And if the public school system takes stuff from them and the public school system still does the bulk of the education, that's fine. I don't really, you know, I have no objection to it. Like, it just, again, doesn't interest me that much. I don't hate mm-hmm. it because it's a public system. I hate it because mm-hmm. it's a public system that's a complete disaster.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I keep struggling with whether I have a partial agreement with, you know, a significant agreement with you, or you know, I hear terms like bulldoze the whole system, and I hear a very, very, very exaggerated idea of the difference between the public school system of, you know, 1950 and today.
I would say 1900. By 1950. You're already starting to see this problem, right? I mean, you're already starting to see, I think in general, the culture, the central planning culture set in over the 20th century. The idea that what we need is, like five really, really smart people to decide what we should do. And then those five really, really smart people are going to, as much as possible, reduce everyone else in the system to a cog and tell them every little tiny thing that they should do. And push that all out.
One thing that my uncle, who's an education expert, taught me a bunch of years ago when I was talking about some kind of policy scheme I had in mind for education was, you know, what you know, all you smart kids, what you never recognize is there's 2.1 million teachers in this country, you know, and they're not all going to be the best and the brightest. And you actually do need a system that kind of gets the most out of a lot of people who are not going to be Ivy League graduates or whatever. It's a little like the military in that sense. And that's an important point. For as much as you want to say, oh, you should have a system where teachers can just innovate freely, and if they don't like the curriculum, they could just use some other curriculum. I mean, for the most part, and, you know, if you deal with teachers a lot, you realize most of them actually, you know, without a curriculum, they're a little bit lost. So
okay, but the flip side of this is that you then have to, when they innovate, you have to provide feedback on that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like the other problem with the public school system, there's no feedback. You don't know. A teacher decides to teach in Latin, and there's no one providing feedback saying, you know, hey, this doesn't work so well, you should stop that. So what we do is we try to prospective good to me. Okay, so I think this is maybe what gets down to the bottom of, and I'm very libertarian and Hayekian about this. To me, a good system is a system that doesn't specify rules in advance and then try to make everyone carry out those rules in advance exactly as is. A good system is, as a system of providing public services, is one that lets people try things, and then when you try them, says of 90% of it, hey, that doesn't work. Stop.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And the central planning idea is why, you know, Soviet markets were bad at providing everything. They didn't work because it was all positive feedback. It was all, you should do this, I will now push out 77 rules. No negative feedback. Never like, mm-hmm. you know what,
right.
Your kids aren't getting any better, so you should stop
right.
that and do something different. And I think actually, in fact, I think a lot of the curriculums that turn out to work really well for poor kids are incredibly rule-based. But my thing is that what I don't want is for some central agency to say, okay, well, this is the curriculum. First of all, because that rule-based curriculum can't be picked by a central system, because the teachers unions come in, and I'm sympathetic but not terribly, and say, like, look, this is really boring. This isn't why I became a teacher. I didn't become a teacher to become a robot who reads this stuff out loud. I became a teacher because I love kids and I want to be creative and so forth. And because there's no negative feedback that says, well, but unfortunately your way doesn't work, so you're going to do this instead, they just...
But that's the opposite of the point you just made.
No, it isn't. Right? As a system, you discover what works and then you do what works. Okay, everyone in the entire United States, every auto plant will do a lot of the same things. And they will do them over and over again because they've discovered the best way to do it, and then they do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But Ford's there is a big difference.
Working out very well for the Ford Motor Company.
Indeed. But we did not have Henry Ford starting out as the czar, the auto manufacturing czar, saying, well, I've decided this is the best way to do it, and this is how we're just going to do it. And no one else, no one, you know, I'm going to have a committee that's going to tell me, we're all going to sit around and think really big thoughts, and then we're going to produce a report that will say this is the best way to do it. What Henry Ford did was invent the assembly line, and it was so awesome everyone else had to copy him. Mm-hmm. What the Soviets did was have a big committee that did a lot of research and came up with the best way to do X, and then didn't, you know, and then pushed it out to all of their factories. So it's not that you won't, that there won't be standardization. What it is that there won't be, that the standardization will be picked because it will emerge organically out of all of the things that we've tried and failed, rather than emerging from a centrally planned solution. Okay. Centrally planned solutions are almost always the worst way. Over the long run, over the short run, they can look like they're outperforming the market, but over the long run, they always seem to. The Soviet Union industrialized really fast. And temporarily made people think that central planning was the wave of the future. But in fact, it always turns out that the market does better because the market copes with change and the market learns and central planners don't learn.
Okay, but you're talking about something completely different when you're talking about, there's no price signaling in the education marketplace. People are not very smart consumers, and we can't afford to have them not be very smart consumers. You need to construct a massive system that, to create the economic incentives to make that system improve or not, is very hard. There are public choice. It's a public good. There are public choice about how we do it. We've got lots of feedback now. Some of it we're measuring the wrong things in No Child Left Behind. I think we're very often measuring the wrong things, but we're building a huge amount of feedback into the system about what works and what doesn't. We've got charter schools that are creating a huge amount of feedback, also creating a lot of disasters. A lot of kids who are just kind of losing a year or two in a charter school that seemed like a great idea but really wasn't. And that comes at a huge cost for kids. I just feel, I mean, I don't, I want to be a voucher supporter, but I have nothing in common with the idea that the public school system has something in common with Stalin's schemes.
Okay, but like you say, there's no price signal. You're right, but there would be if there were vouchers. And I think that, you know, you're right, we need better data. And I think that the government should be, I mean, the government, especially if it's paying for these, I think it should certainly for anyone who can't afford to give their kid a top-class school, that the government should pay for it. That the government's great at it should be gathering the data that people use to make these decisions. That doesn't mean the government has to make the decision. The government can provide data on what doesn't work and let people use price signals to make the decision about what they do. And what I'm trying to do is inject price signals into a system that doesn't have any.
Right.
And I think I'm not really sure what you're saying. You know, there's no price signals in education. There is a price signal in education. Private school education works very well on price signals. People can observe whether their kids can read or not. They can observe whether their kids have, the amenities that they want them to have and what sort of education they can get. The problem is that we don't know that all parents are going to be smart consumers of education. I'm also perfectly happy with the government setting sort of a basic bar and saying below this, I just won't. If you don't hit this bar, you don't get voucher money.
Right.
But I'm talking about a really basic bar in terms of student performance, not whether it uses, for example, union teachers. I think a lot of the problems with vouchers have been the insistence that, you know, if we have vouchers or charter schools, what we should really do is have a school that looks pretty much exactly like the existing public school, except it's got a pretty new name on it.
Well, charter schools, I mean, they often look very different. But in some
districts, I think you'll agree that the unions capture the charter school system and the administrative people and so forth and made it so that the charter school system has basically as little freedom as any other of the schools in the system.
Okay. Have you read Rick Kallenberg's book about Shanker?
No.
I highly recommend it. I highly recommend it. And I think you might come out of it with not with this caricatured view of teachers' unions as.
But I don't have a caricatured view of them as like the source of all evil in the education system. I have a view of the unions as part of a power structure that avoids change, mm-hmm. and certainly that avoids change that doesn't benefit it. Right? Like all unions are in favor of reducing class size because it means more teachers, but all. Everyone in any system resists change. If you worked in a corporation, you've seen the same thing. Mm-hmm. The difference is that in urban systems where unions vote powerfully, they have a huge amount of power. Like the bigger your school district, the more disproportionate the power the unions will have because they're concentrated and the people are dispersed. So in a small school district, the unions don't have very, like the district my mom grew up in is a small town, the unions don't have that much power. First of all, because they're wealthy by local standards, but also because there's just, like, the whole electorate is kind of mobilized on this issue. But when you get to someplace like New York City where half the electorate may not have kids and so forth, the only interested parties who really get mobilized on this on a day-to-day basis are the unions. The affluent parents just tend to pick up their kids and leave. They don't vote on the issue of schools right. very much.
Right.
So I think teachers unions in some urban areas are really dysfunctional. Otherwise, I think they're whatever, they're fine. But in some urban areas, they're a huge problem. And not because the teachers are inherently evil or unions are inherently evil or whatever, but just because any person resists any change that looks like it will make them worse off. And certainly the unions have a disproportionate power now, and they resist losing that power. Okay. It's not like they're Satan or anything. It's just sort of natural human behavior.
Okay. Well, I think we're at an hour yes. and 26. I think we've kind of exhausted this topic. I think I'm going to go back to being a former voucher supporter. But it was an interesting conversation about it. We had a bunch of other topics, which I don't think we're going to.
Yeah, I think our readers are probably.
But I think this is. I think that, the debate you've started has been a good and intelligent one, and I think most people have been, participating in it in pretty good faith. So I'm glad we're.
Yeah, my comment threads are in the 150 range on a lot.
Yeah, good. It's one of those flags you can wave. I remember once when I had my own blog and it was kind of thriving. I once just sort of like alluded to myself as a voucher supporter and got massive comments.
It is funny like what some issues it's kind of obvious. Like if I mention Israel Palestine, I might as well just shut the blog down. Because that's all anyone's going to do is shout at each other. But then some issues like school vouchers, where it's just not obvious in advance that you're going to just tap into this rich vein of intense hostility.
Well, it goes – no, it's not just hostility. I mean, the reason it grabs that is because it does get to some of the core issues of public versus private and goods in society and obligation to one another and kind of destiny of our economy and our life, and it's tied into it's sort of easier to work with than some of the healthcare issues, but it reflects some of the same choices between a kind of individualized system and one that does have some central centralized program in it, and I think a lot of other issues are maybe sublimated into the issue, and then of course for parents it's all they ever talk about. I mean, we had our daughter's little potluck dinner for the for the families in her first grade class, and it was like half the conversation was about, well, how happy are you with the public school system, half of it was how much are, people thinking about whether they should or should, whether they're going to exercise the right of exit or not, mostly agreeing not to. But
well, I actually think, and I will close with this and then I won't, but I mean, what actually interests me with progressive supporters of vouchers is that we're not having a debate, right? Almost no one is having a debate. Some people do, I guess they want a rebate on their tax money so they can educate their kids outside of the system. But most of the people like me who are passionate about vouchers, I don't have kids. I don't want a rebate on my tax money. I'm willing to spend more on the schools if that's what it takes to educate kids well. And so the debate about healthcare is by and large a debate about, is this a good that society should provide? And in schools, we've answered that question. Society should provide every kid a good education. That's just one of the things that society is supposed to do for whatever ideological reason you believe. And what's odd to me is that I feel like we're having in school a debate that we've had in every other area of government and answered a different way, which was, should the government – we know that the government is supposed to pay for this thing. But should the government actually be in the business of manufacturing this thing that the government needs to provide, or should it buy it on the market? And with the exception of the military and police, where I can make sort of a good classic public good argument that these goods are non-rival and non-excludable and for various other reasons are hard to actually buy, and then also that you want the state to be providing it because you want them to limit sort of – you don't want to give people too much freedom to act violently, and you want to constrain their actions quite a bit more than you can if you buy it.
This is a pre-Blackwater answer, but okay.
But it's not clear. Yes, but yes and no. Anyway, but Blackwater might be the argument for that. Yes, this is a good that the state should just provide. We shouldn't be buying it on the private market, for exactly this reason. But for every other industry, basically everyone has now concluded that the answer is no. The state should not be in the business of running this stuff. The state should not run coal mines. It should not make steel. It should not make autos. It should not manufacture airframes. The state isn't as good at doing stuff as the private sector is. It's good at taking money and buying stuff that has to be bought for various reasons. It's pretty efficient at transferring money from one person to another. But that in general, we've said, no, the state shouldn't make stuff because for all of these reasons that I've been outlining at great, undoubtedly tedious and boring length for the last hour, it's not good at providing stuff. And so instead, we should have a model where, as much as possible, the government just pays other people to do stuff for people that the government has decided should be done.
Okay.
And so I'm not sure why liberals are so vehemently committed to the idea of a system, to the idea that the government should manufacture our education, rather than that the government should be in the business of saying, like, look, everyone has to get an awesome education. I'm going to spend this much money on it, and then I'm going to test the hell out of the kids to find out how you're doing. As we do with healthcare, not test them and not check how you're doing, and just give you a bunch of money. But whatever it is, why we're so committed to the idea of government provision of the service, I don't really get that. But I think we're probably out of time.
All right, but I want to answer that very quickly, which is because the system as a whole works incredibly well, and it's created, you know, it is responsible for so much of the wealth and well-being we take for granted in this country. Is a universal public school system, which, you know, 90% of kids go to, and works extraordinarily well for 90% of those kids, and there's nothing that in any libertarian dream could replace that.
Well, I guess we'll have to agree.
It's our greatest. It's our greatest national. Other than the Brooklyn Bridge, it's our greatest national monument.
It's certainly been interesting talking to you, and I hope we do this again.
Likewise. Good, Megan. Thank you.
Cheers.
Okay. Bye-bye.